Chapter 15. For the rest of the subterranean journey after his long sleep in the firelit cave, Ransom was somewhat light-headed with hunger and fatigue. He remembers lying still after he woke for what seemed many hours, and even debating with himself whether it was worth going on. The actual moment of decision has vanished from his mind. Pictures come back in a chaotic, disjointed fashion. There was a long gallery open to the fire pit on one side, and a terrible place where clouds of steam went up for ever and ever. Doubtless one of the many torrents that roared in the neighbourhood here fell into the depth of the fire. Beyond that were great halls, still dimly illuminated and full of unknown mineral wealth that sparkled and danced in the light and mocked his eyes, as if he were exploring a hall of mirrors by the help of a pocket torch. It seemed to him also, though this may have been delirium, that he came through a vast cathedral space, which was more like the work of art than that of nature, with two great thrones at one end and chairs on either hand too large for human occupants. If the things were real, he never found any explanation of them. There was a dark tunnel in which a wind from heaven knows where was blowing and drove sand in his face. There was also a place where he himself walked in darkness and looked down through fathom below fathom of shafts and natural arches and winding gulfs onto a smooth floor lit with a cold green light. And as he stood and looked, it seemed to him that four of the great earth beetles, dwarfed by distance to the size of gnats and crawling two by two, came slowly into sight. And they were drawing behind them a flat car, and on the car, upright, unshaken, stood a mantled form, huge and still and slender. And driving its strange team, it passed on with insufferable majesty and went out of sight. Assuredly the inside of this world was not for man, but it was for something. And it appeared to Ransom that there might, if a man could find it, be some way to renew the old pagan practice of propitiating the local gods of unknown places in such fashion that it was no offence to God himself, but only a prudent and courteous apology for trespass. That thing, that swathed form in its chariot, was no doubt his fellow creature. It did not follow that they were equals or had an equal right in the underland. A long time after this came the drumming, the boom-ba-ba-ba-boom-boom, out of pitch darkness, distant at first, then all around him, then dying away after endless prolongation of echoes in the black labyrinth. Then came the fountain of cold light, a column, as of water, shining with some radiance of its own, and pulsating, and never any nearer, however long he travelled, and at last suddenly eclipsed. He did not find what it was. And so, after more strangeness and grandeur and labour than I can tell, there came a moment when his feet slid without warning on clay, a wild grasp, a spasm of terror, and he was spluttering and struggling in deep, swift-flowing water. He thought that even if he escaped being battered to death against the walls of the channel, he would presently plunge along with the stream into the pit of fire. But the channel must have been very straight, and the current perhaps was less violent than he had supposed. At all events, he never touched the sides. He lay helpless, in the end, rushing forward through echoing darkness. It lasted a long time. You will understand that what with expectation of death and weariness and the great noise, he was confused in mind. Looking back on the adventure afterwards, it seemed to him that he floated out of blackness into greyness, and then into an inexplicable chaos of semi-transparent blues and greens and whites. There was a hint of arches above his head and faintly shining columns, but all vague and all obliterating one another as soon as seen. It looked like a cave of ice, but it was too warm for that. And the roof above him seemed to be itself rippling like water, but this was doubtless a reflection. A moment later and he was rushed out into the broad daylight and air and warmth and rolled head over heels and deposited, dazzled and breathless, in the shallows of a great pool. He was now almost too weak to move. Something in the air and the wide silence which made a background to the lonely crying of birds told him that he was on a high mountain top. He rolled, rather than crawled, out of the pool onto sweet blue turf. Looking back whence he had come, he saw a river pouring from the mouth of a cave that seemed indeed to be made of ice. Under it the water was spectral blue, but near where he lay it was warm amber. There was mist and freshness and dew all about him. At his side rose a cliff mantled with streamers of bright vegetation, but gleaming like glass where its own surface showed through. But this he heeded little. There were rich clusters of a grape-like fruit glowing under the little pointed leaves, and he could reach them without getting up. Eating passed into sleeping by a transition he could never remember. At this point, it becomes increasingly difficult to give Ransom's experiences in any certain order. How long he lay beside the river at the cavern mouth, eating and sleeping and waking only to eat and sleep again, he has no idea. He thinks it was only a day or two, but from the state of his body when this period of convalescence ended, I should imagine it must have been more like a fortnight or 3 weeks. It was a time to be remembered only in dreams, as we remember infancy. Indeed, it was a second infancy in which he was breastfed by the planet Venus herself, unweaned till he moved from that place. Three impressions of this long Sabbath remain. One is the endless sound of rejoicing water. Another is the delicious life that he sucked from the clusters which almost seemed to bow themselves unasked into his upstretched hands. The third is the song, now high in air above him, now welling up as if from glens and valleys far below. It floated through his sleep and was the first sound at every waking. It was formless as the song of a bird, yet it was not a bird's voice. As a bird's voice is to a flute, so this was to a cello, low and ripe and tender, full-bellied, rich and golden brown, passionate too, but not with the passions of men. Because he was weaned so gradually from this state of rest, I cannot give his impressions of the place he lay in bit by bit as he came to take it in. But when he was cured and his mind was clear again, this was what he saw. The cliffs out of which his river had broken through the cave were not of ice, but of some kind of translucent rock. Any little splinter broken off them was as transparent as glass. But the cliffs themselves, when you looked at them close, seemed to become opaque about 6 inches from the surface. If you waded upstream into the cave and then turned back and looked towards the light, the edges of the arch which formed the cave's mouth were distinctly transparent, and everything looked blue inside the cave. He did not know what happened at the top of these cliffs. Before him the lawn of blue turf continued level for about 30 paces, and then dropped with a steep slope, leading the river down in a series of cataracts. The slope was covered with flowers, which shook continually in a light breeze. It went down a long way, and ended in a winding and wooded valley which curled out of sight on his right hand round a majestic slope. But beyond that, lower down, so much lower down as to be almost incredible, one caught the point of mountain tops, and beyond that, fainter yet, the hint of still lower valleys, and then a vanishing of everything in golden haze. On the opposite side of this valley, the earth leaped up in great sweeps and folds of almost Himalayan height to the red rocks. They were not red like Devonshire cliffs. They were true rose-red, as if they had been painted. Their brightness astonished him, and so did the needle-like sharpness of their spires, until it occurred to him that he was in a young world, and that these mountains might, geologically speaking, be in their infancy. Also, they might be farther off than they looked. To his left and behind him, the crystal cliffs shut off his view. To his right they soon ended, and beyond them the ground rose to another and nearer peak, a much lower one than those he saw across the valley. The fantastic steepness of all the slopes confirmed his idea that he was on a very young mountain. Except for the song, it was all very still. When he saw birds flying, they were usually a long way below him. On the slopes to his right, and, less distinctly, on the slope of the great massif which faced him, there was a continual rippling effect which he could not account for. It was like water flowing. But since, if it were a stream on the remoter mountain, it would have to be a stream 2 or 3 miles wide, this seemed improbable. In trying to put the completed picture together, I have omitted something which, in fact, made it a long job for Ransom to get that picture. The whole place was subject to mists. It kept on vanishing in a veil of saffron or very pale gold, and reappearing again, almost as if the golden sky-roof, which indeed looked only a few feet above the mountain-tops, were opening and pouring down riches upon the world. Day by day, as he came to know more of the place, Ransom also came to know more of the state of his own body. For a long time he was too stiff almost to move, and even an incautious breath made him wince. It healed, however, surprisingly quickly. But just as a man who has had a fall only discovers the real hurt when the minor bruises and cuts are less painful, so Ransom was nearly well before he detected his most serious injury. It was a wound in his heel. The shape made it quite clear that the wound had been inflicted by human teeth, the nasty, blunt teeth of our own species, which crush and grind more than they cut. Oddly enough, he had no recollection of this particular bite in any of his innumerable tussles with the unman. It did not look unhealthy, but it was still bleeding. It was not bleeding at all fast, but nothing he could do would stop it. But he worried very little about this. Neither the future nor the past really concerned him at this period. Wishing and fearing were modes of consciousness for which he seemed to have lost the faculty. Nevertheless, there came a day when he felt the need of some activity, and yet did not feel ready to leave the little lair between the pool and the cliff, which had become like a home. He employed that day in doing something which may appear rather foolish, and yet at the time it seemed to him that he could hardly omit it. He had discovered that the substance of the translucent cliffs was not very hard. Now he took a sharp stone of a different kind and cleared a wide space on the cliff wall of vegetation. Then he made measurements and spaced it all out carefully, and after a few hours had produced the following. The language was old Solar, but the letters were Roman. Within these caves was burned the body of Edward Rolls Weston, a learned now of the world which those who inhabit it call Tellus, but the Eldela Thalcandra. He was born when Tellus had completed 1,896 revolutions about Arbol since the time when Maleldil, blessed be he, was born as a Hnau in Thalcandra. He studied the properties of bodies, and first of the Tellurians travelled through deep heaven to Malacandra and to Perelandra, where he gave up his will and reason to the bent Eldil when Tellus was making the 1,942nd revolution after the birth of Maleldil, blessed be he. "That was a tomfool thing to do," said Ransom to himself contentedly as he lay down again. "No one will ever read it. But there ought to be some record. He was a great physicist, after all. Anyway, it has given me some exercise." He yawned prodigiously and settled down to yet another 12 hours of sleep. The next day he was better, and began taking little walks, not going down, but strolling to and fro on the hillside on each side of the cave. The following day he was better still, but on the third day he was well and ready for adventures. He set out very early in the morning and began to follow the watercourse down the hill. The slope was very steep, but there were no outcroppings of rock, and the turf was soft and springy, and to his surprise he found that the descent brought no weariness to his knees. When he had been going about half an hour, and the peaks of the opposite mountain were now too high to see, and the crystal cliffs behind him were only a distant glare, he came to a new kind of vegetation. He was approaching a forest of little trees, whose trunks were only about 2.5 feet high. But from the top of each trunk there grew long streamers, which did not rise in the air, but flowed in the wind downhill and parallel to the ground. Thus, when he went in among them, he found himself wading knee-deep and more in a continually rippling sea of them, a sea which presently tossed all about him as far as his eye could reach. It was blue in colour, but far lighter than the blue of the turf, almost a Cambridge blue at the centre of each streamer, but dying away at their tasselled and feathery edges into a delicacy of bluish grey, which it would take the subtlest effects of smoke and cloud to rival in our world. The soft, almost impalpable caresses of the long thin leaves on his flesh, the low singing, rustling, whispering music, and the frolic movement all about him, began to set his heart beating with that almost formidable sense of delight which he had felt before in Perelandra. He realized that these dwarf forests, these ripple trees, as he now christened them, were the explanation of that water-like movement he had seen on the farther slopes. When he was tired, he sat down, and found himself at once in a new world. The streamers now flowed above his head. He was in a forest made for dwarfs, a forest with a blue transparent roof, continually moving and casting an endless dance of lights and shades upon its mossy floor. And presently he saw that it was indeed made for dwarfs. Through the moss, which here was of extraordinary fineness, he saw the hithering and thithering of what at first he took for insects, but what proved, on closer inspection, to be tiny mammals. There were many mountain mice, exquisite scale models of those he had seen on the Forbidden Island, each about the size of a bumblebee. There were little miracles of grace, which looked more like horses than anything he had yet seen on this world, though they resembled proto-hippos rather than his modern representative. How can I avoid treading on thousands of these? He wondered. But they were not really very numerous, and the main crowd of them seemed to be all moving away on his left. When he made to rise, he noticed that there were already very few of them in sight. He continued to wade down through the rippling streamers. It was like a sort of vegetable surf bathing for about an hour longer. Then he came into woods and presently to a river with a rocky course flowing across his path to the right. He had, in fact, reached the wooded valley and knew that the ground which sloped upwards through trees on the far side of the water was the beginning of the great ascent. Here was amber shade and solemn height under the forest roof, and rocks wet with cataracts, and, over all, the noise of that deep singing. It was so loud now and so full of melody that he went downstream, a little out of his way, to look for its origin. This brought him almost at once out of stately aisles and open glades into a different kind of wood. Soon he was pressing his way through thornless thickets, all in bloom. His head was covered with the petals that showered on it, his sides gilded with pollen. Much that his fingers touched was gummy, and at each pace his contact with soil and bush appeared to wake new odours that darted into his brain, and there begot wild and enormous pleasures. The noise was very loud now, and the thicket very dense, so that he could not see a yard ahead, when the music stopped suddenly. There was a sound of rustling and broken twigs, and he made hastily in that direction, but found nothing. He had almost decided to give up the search when the song began again, a little farther away. Once more he made after it. Once more the creature stopped singing and evaded him. He must have played thus at hide-and-seek with it for the best part of an hour before his search was rewarded. Treading delicately during one of the loudest bursts of music, he at last saw through the flowery branches a black something. Standing still whenever it stopped singing, and advancing with great caution whenever it began again, he stalked it for 10 minutes. At last it was in full view, and singing, and ignorant that it was watched. It sat upright like a dog, black and sleek and shiny. But its shoulders were high above Ransom's head, and the forelegs on which they were pillared were like young trees, and the wide soft pads on which they rested were large as those of a camel. The enormous rounded belly was white, and far up above the shoulders the neck rose like that of a horse. The head was in profile from where Ransom stood, the mouth wide open as it sang of joy in thick coming trills, and the music almost visibly rippled in its glossy throat. He stared in wonder at the wide liquid eyes and the quivering sensitive nostrils. Then the creature stopped, saw him, and darted away, and stood now a few paces distant on all four legs, not much smaller than a young elephant, swaying a long bushy tail. It was the first thing in Perelandra which seemed to show any fear of man. Yet it was not fear. When he called to it, it came nearer. It put its velvet nose into his hand and endured his touch. But almost at once it darted back and, bending its long neck, buried its head in its paws. He could make no headway with it, and when at length it retreated out of sight, he did not follow it. To do so would have seemed an injury to its fawn-like shyness, to the yielding softness of its expression, its evident wish to be forever a sound and only a sound in the thickest centre of untravelled woods. He resumed his journey. A few seconds later the song broke out behind him, louder and lovelier than before, as if in a paean of rejoicing at its recovered privacy. Ransom now addressed himself seriously to the ascent of the great mountain, and in a few minutes emerged from the woods onto its lower slopes. He continued ascending so steeply that he used hands as well as feet for about half an hour, and was puzzled to find himself doing it with almost no fatigue. Then he came once more into a region of ripple trees. This time the wind was blowing the streamers not down the mountainside, but up it, so that his course had to the eye the astonishing appearance of lying through a wide blue waterfall which flowed the wrong way, curving and foaming towards the heights. Whenever the wind failed for a second or two, the extreme ends of the streamers began to curl back under the influence of gravitation, so that it looked as if the heads of the waves were being flung back by a high wind. He continued going up through this for a long time, never feeling any real need for rest, but resting occasionally nonetheless. He was now so high that the crystal cliffs from which he had set out appeared on a level with him as he looked back across the valley. He now saw that the land leaped up beyond them into a whole waste of the same translucent formation, which ended in a kind of glassy tableland. Under the naked sun of our own planet, this would have been too bright to look at. Here it was a tremulous dazzle, changing every moment under the undulations which the Perelandrian sky receives from the ocean. To the left of this tableland were some peaks of greenish rock. He went on. Little by little the peaks and the tableland sank and grew smaller, and presently there arose beyond them an exquisite haze, like vaporized amethyst and emerald and gold. And the edge of this haze rose as he rose, and became at last the horizon of the sea, high lifted above the hills. And the sea grew ever larger, and the mountains less, and the horizon of the sea rose and rose till all the lower mountains behind him seemed to be lying at the bottom of a great bowl of sea. But ahead, the interminable slope, now blue, now violet, now flickering with the smoke-like upward movement of the ripple trees, soared up and up to the sky. And now the wooded valley in which he had met the singing beast was invisible, and the mountain from which he had set out looked no more than a little swell on the slope of the great mountain. And there was not a bird in the air, nor any creature underneath the streamers. And still he went on, unwearied, but always bleeding a little from his heel. He was not lonely nor afraid. He had no desires, and did not even think about reaching the top, nor why he should reach it. To be always climbing this was not, in his present mood, a process, but a state, and in that state of life he was content. It did once cross his mind that he had died and felt no weariness because he had no body. The wound in his heel convinced him that this was not so. But if it had been so indeed, and these had been transmortal mountains, his journey could hardly have been more great and strange. That night he lay on the slopes between the stems of the ripple trees, with the sweet-scented, wind-proof, delicately whispering roof above his head, and when morning came he resumed his journey. At first he climbed through dense mists. When these parted, he found himself so high that the concave of the sea seemed to close him in on every side but one, and on that one he saw the rose-red peaks, no longer very distant, and a pass between the two nearest ones through which he caught a glimpse of something soft and flushed. And now he began to feel a strange mixture of sensations. A sense of perfect duty to enter that secret place which the peaks were guarding, combined with an equal sense of trespass. He dared not go up that pass. He dared not do otherwise. He looked to see an angel with a flaming sword. He knew that Maleldil bade him go on. "This is the holiest and the most unholy thing I have ever done," he thought. But he went on. And now he was right in the pass. The peaks on either hand were not of red rock, cores of rock they must have had, but what he saw were great Matterhorns clothed in flowers, a flower shaped something like a lily, but tinted like a rose. And soon the ground on which he trod was carpeted with the same flowers, and he must crush them as he walked. And here at last his bleeding left no visible trace. From the neck between the two peaks he looked a little down, for the top of the mountain was a shallow cup. He saw a valley, a few acres in size, as secret as a valley in the top of a cloud. A valley pure rose-red, with 10 or 12 of the glowing peaks about it, and in the centre a pool, married in pure unrippled clearness to the gold of the sky. The lilies came down to its very edge and lined all its bays and headlands. Yielding without resistance to the awe which was gaining upon him, he walked forward with slow paces and bowed head. There was something white near the water's edge. An altar? A patch of white lilies among the red? A tomb? But whose tomb? No, it was not a tomb, but a coffin, open and empty, and its lid lying beside it. Then, of course, he understood. This thing was own brother to the coffin-like chariot in which the strength of angels had brought him from Earth to Venus. It was prepared for his return. If he had said, "It is for my burial," his feelings would not have been very different. And while he thought of this, he became gradually aware that there was something odd about the flowers at two places in his immediate neighbourhood. Next, he perceived that the oddity was an oddity in the light. Thirdly, that it was in the air as well as on the ground. Then, as the blood pricked his veins and a familiar yet strange sense of diminished being possessed him, he knew that he was in the presence of two Eldila. He stood still. It was not for him to speak.